Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and today I'm joined by Lee Carlo and only Lee Carlo. Jeremy couldn't make it to the podcast this week. He's busy on the film he's working on.
He's actually at a wedding.
Oh, is he at a wedding?
Yeah, well, and he couldn't see the movie.
Well, same difference.
I don't know. I went to a wedding a couple weeks ago, and I was still able to see the movie. Couldn't make it on the podcast, but I saw the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's my point. Like, you know, wedding, work, potato, excuses is all I'm hearing from Jeremy, basically. So he's not here. So it's Lee and I today, and we're going to be tackling the new film in theaters, 30 Minutes or Less, starring Jesse Eisenberg and Aziz Ansari. We're then going to have a tie-in discussion about directors and actors who like to work together often. And then we're going to wrap it up with our top five movies based on real crimes.
The thing is, Kate makes some pretty questionable decisions, like moving to Atlanta.
Whatever, why are we talking about my sister?
I don't know.
You want to have sex with my sister, don't you?
Okay, your sister is attractive.
My twin sister? Which is basically like having sex with me?
Remember graduation night?
We were nailing Tina Scotto.
No, I was actually having the best night of my life with your sister.
What? You deflowered my sister? And I know all the details?
So let's go right on into the movie here. Lee, this movie is only 83 minutes long. Did you get the sense from this movie that they were just trying to wrap it up as quickly as possible to get out of it because they wanted to keep it as seemingly as short as possible? I mean, I kind of got that sense, so I'm wondering what you thought.
Yeah, it definitely kind of had that feel, like, let's get in, get out mentality to the way it was made. But it's funny because, like, if you have a movie that's called 30 Minutes or Less here, mm-hmm. and I think one of the problems with the script was how much time Jesse Eisenberg had to rob this bank when he had the bomb attached to him. Like, the whole 30 minutes or less theme disappeared, and it just became 10 hours or less. And then at the same time, you have a movie that's 80 minutes long. So, if you really want to get into the timelines of this movie, both within it and the length of it, it's just kind of an interesting discussion.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because you're right. I mean, the movie flies by, and when I say that it's short, I actually say that that's kind of a good thing, because I think a lot of times nowadays you got a lot of movies that one of the biggest complaints is that they're just too long, there's too much stuff in it, they could have cut 15 to 20 minutes out of it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think 30 minutes or less is mercifully short in that sense, but I think it also acts to its detriment a little bit as well. Because I feel like there's a lot of loose ends that don't get tied up. I feel like it kind of ends abruptly. But I would agree with you, too, that, you know, they set the bomb on his chest for 10 hours. And, the whole time he has it, it's basically just a means for him and his best friend to try to work through the issues that they're having. Because time isn't really an issue in this movie, despite the title.
Yeah, they have time to spare at the end. It really takes away from kind of the drama of the bomb being attached to his chest. Essentially, there's two ways for it to detonate. They have a detonator, and then or the clock runs out, and the only suspense comes from the actual detonator. And essentially, the I don't know issues that the two friends have, played by Danny McBride and Nick Swardson, and their issues are kind of what deal with the detonator, and then the time limit is supposed to be the issues between Chet and Nick, played by Eisenberg and Ansari. But that one never really has a deadline, you know what I mean? It just kind of is there. The bomb's just there.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, I mean, they're really... I feel like it was written in the script for that long so that they knew they'd be able to give themselves enough time to do whatever they needed to do with Aziz and Jesse Eisenberg's characters in terms of letting them work through it. You know, I'm sure they probably, maybe they originally set it for less so that there was actually that suspense that came with, okay, we only have a certain amount of time. But I feel like in the writing process, they just expanded it so that they'd have the ability to just, you know, deal with whatever they needed to deal with in that day. And then, oh, okay, well, when the night comes, that's when the bomb's going to be ready to go off, basically.
Yeah. But, I mean, I definitely agree with you about the length of this movie. I think much longer, and it would have really started to drag. There wasn't enough there to make it much longer, and it's nice that director Ruben Fleischer knew that and you know, stayed in control of the length of his movie, because you're right, these are the kinds of movies that can get bogged down by, you know, additional storylines, like a relationship between Danny McBride and a girl, maybe, or anything else that, you know, could have lengthen this movie to kind of normal comedy length, but wouldn't necessarily have helped it. Now, was it a great 100 hour and 20 minutes? No, not really. It could, like, I did feel a little shortchanged on a number of occasions, but that didn't necessarily have to do with the length as much as it may have had to do with the development of certain characters, the conclusion of certain storylines and whatnot, and I don't know, there were aspects of it that seemed like a cheap out for this movie, you know, like the way that they get away at the very end, it seemed very out of character for Eisenberg to do what he did, you know, and I think it was so the movie could end, really, like, so that, you know, every character had an ending, and when you have an hour and 20 minutes, it's really hard to fit in a conclusion for every character, and I think that's kind of where it got a little bumpy.
I agree. I think certain plot elements like that, the way the film ended, I think were there just to, you know, to formulate the film better rather than it really being what the character would do or really how you know, if it really worked for the story or not. So I agree with you on that point, and I tend to agree with you too that I feel a little bit, I was really excited for this film. I was really looking forward to it. I thought the trailers were pretty good for it. But I felt a little disappointed, too, coming out of it. I mean, I thought it was amusing, and I thought there were funny parts and aspects to it. But I agree. I think we get too much Danny McBride and Nick Swardson, even though I think at times they have a good dynamic between the two of them. I think Danny McBride is just starting to wear thin on me, and I think if he played different characters, he wouldn't, but he always plays the same character over and over. He's Kenny Powers in everything he does, you know?
Yeah.
And that works when he's in Eastbound and Down, which has a lot better writing and better direction and a story arc. But when he's just that character in every single film he does, when he's not really Kenny Powers, it starts to wear on me. So I feel like aspects of that relationship dragged. Very few moments with Jesse Eisenberg and Aziz dragged a little bit, but I think overall the chemistry between Eisenberg and Aziz Ansari was pretty good in terms of their friendship, so there was enough humor there to get me through it.
I agree, and I think this movie was definitely funny. I laughed a lot throughout it, but in regards to McBride and Swardson, that it got old. They were so crude and so raunchy to the point where it was so over the top. And it just got old and almost annoying. And you just, like, what, it wasn't, that's what she said jokes were just, like, flopping up everywhere. Jokes about, I can't say a lot of what they were talking about, but the fellatio jokes and whatnot. And it's just like, come on, like, let's grow up a little bit here. I'm not so highbrow that I can't laugh at a few, you know, raunchy jokes. But it just got to the point where it's like, is that all these characters are? And I think that was the point. I think these were supposed to just be, like, you know, really immature, brainless characters who somehow managed to pull this thing together. But it wasn't entertaining, it wasn't funny, and it kind of hurt what was otherwise, I think, a really funny movie.
And the thing with McBride, too, is I feel like there was just a lot of, like, improvised dialogue that he was doing probably on set that happened to make it into the screenplay, because unless this was written specifically for Danny McBride, and, like, he was, you know, they knew he was already attached or whatever, then It had to have been that. And I feel like that was a lot of the stuff that made it into it that really kind of forced it to drag and kind of just made it, like, more of, like, the same Danny McBride that we've seen, you know, over and over and over again.
Yeah, there was a lot of what I would say was improvised lines of dialogue, because there were those quick one-liners that I thought, for the most part, were pretty funny. And but there was that aspect of those one-liners that, like, almost like in the editing room, they wanted to get every single one in. So the scene would drag on, like, one or two one-liners too long. And, it, you know, it's good because this is a comedy, and it's a relatively lowbrow comedy. So you have those lines in there, and they're not going to necessarily hurt the movie overall. But, again, I guess it comes back to the fact that this movie is an hour and 20 minutes long, so it's not a big deal. But I can only imagine if they, you know, allowed every single one-liner in, because scenes did seem to get capped off, every single one, with a witty one-liner about something. Almost to the point where it was like, oh, now I know the scene's going to end because they threw that in there. And that wasn't just with McBride and Swartzen, that was with Eisenberg and Ansaria too. And I don't know, I thought they were all funny. It's just so hard to get kind of a read on what this movie was trying to do. Like, was it trying to do anything other than make us laugh? Because, you know, the plot points were weak. Like we said, the timeline wasn't really very dramatic because of how long Eisenberg had to rob this bank. And so, yeah, I laughed. I guess it was a good time. Is that really all this movie was? I mean, you're working with Eisenberg, who's coming off an Oscar-nominated performance. Fleischer did Zombieland, which was very well received. I liked it. I didn't love it. But, I mean, you got a pretty good cast of talent here. And, you know, everybody likes McBride, regardless of whether he's doing the same thing. I just wonder if this was kind of a waste, really. Like, and it begins with the concept, like, 30 minutes or less. Here's a kid who delivers pizza. He has to do it 30 minutes or less. His life kind of sucks. Then he has to do something in a certain amount of time, and they don't even do, like, relate it to that 30 minutes or less thing. So I feel like there's a lot of things just wasted with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call the whole movie a waste, but I definitely see where you're coming from with it. I just feel like it's going to be kind of one of those semi-decent comedies that you'll get a few chuckles from, but you probably won't feel the need to ever really revisit again.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of comedies like that. So, yeah, I don't think it's completely a waste, but, yeah, it's definitely kind of more on the mediocre end, even though there's definitely a few funny bits in it.
Yeah, and one aspect I think we should definitely discuss that hurt this movie was the sentimental aspects of it. Like, I just never bought it. I never really bought Eisenberg going up onto the roof of that building to kind of, you know, profess his love to the girl. And, like, even the scenes between him and his friend just seemed so forced. And, like, I think this movie I want to say it didn't focus enough on those scenes, but I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that it did. I just think they just felt so out of place and so out of character for the characters that they created that they just, you know, they seem dull and unauthentic.
Yeah, I mean, I felt for, like, the first 5 to 10 minutes of their relationship that it felt forced, because, you know, we're just being introduced to, like, the dynamic between them, and I felt like at times, and I kind of hate to say this because I really like Aziz Ansari, I feel like at times he was really stiff in this movie, which I wasn't expecting, but it was a lot of in that beginning part of it, and I think that's what kind of didn't help the dynamic between them. So for the first 5 or 10 minutes, I definitely felt the forced nature of their friendship. But once the bomb was on Eisenberg, and then the actual plot of the movie started moving forward, I liked their relationship a lot more. I thought they worked a lot better together. I thought they played off each other a lot better. And the thing with the girlfriend, I mean, she was in it for such a short period of time that I could kind of care less if, like, it worked or not, because it was so fleeting, even that scene. That, like, the one dramatic scene, like, where, you know, he talks to her on the roof, I feel like it's, like, so fleeting in this whole movie that, for a movie that's so short, too, that it's almost just like an afterthought to have that female character in it at all.
I agree, but then they bring her back as such a big plot point that it's like,
yeah,
well, that should have been a little bit more relevant than it was. And And I refer to things as lazy a lot, and I don't really think that anything about this movie was lazy. I just think this movie kind of never really gave itself a chance. Like, it's like, all right, hey, that scene's funny, good, let's move on, because we got a funny scene. And I wasn't really interested in being much more than that. And if that's the case, fine. But, you know, like I said, don't waste Eisenberg, don't waste Fleischer, don't waste a good cast, and, you know, on a movie that's just going to be like a throwaway comedy. So, Ruben Fleischer and Jesse Eisenberg have worked together before. They did Zombieland. As I mentioned, my feelings are, you know, lukewarm on that movie. I think it's fine, but it pales in comparison to Shaun of the Dead, which is similar in theme and plot.
Mm-hmm.
But here we have Fleischer and Eisenberg working together again with 30 Minutes or Less. And we decided to try to tackle the huge idea of director-actor duos. I mean, there's so many. Every director seems to have an actor. And I actually recently wrote an article on Get Your Film Fix about kind of that second tier of director-actor duos. You know, basically those big directors who we know work with ex-actor or ex-actress, but then there's always somebody else that they work with as well that pops up in their movies. But anyway, today we're going to focus on, you know, the Scorsese's and the De Niro's or DiCaprio's, the big duos that always seem to pop up. And I kind of have a question regarding that, because there are so many, and they always seem to work out. Like, I mean, it's partly because De Niro and DiCaprio are great actors, and Scorsese is a great director, but I'm wondering, does that loyalty ever hurt a director's film? Does he ever cast his man or his girl, and it doesn't work for the role? And I thought of a couple movies where that was the case, but I'm wondering if that crossed your mind at all, or if you've ever noticed that.
In terms of ones that don't work, I don't know, because I don't think, in brainstorming for this, I didn't really think of any ones that didn't. I was kind of thinking of, obviously, the big ones that work out really well, like, you know, you mentioned De Niro or DiCaprio with Scorsese. I was thinking, like, you know, Johnny Depp and Tim Burton, and I guess that's probably the closest one that I think doesn't work out on certain occasions, just because I'm generally just not a Tim Burton fan whatsoever. So, like, I hated Alice in Wonderland, so I would say, yeah, okay, Johnny Depp is the Mad Hatter in that, you know, him and Burton on that didn't work. But then in Ed Wood's one of my favorite movies, and it's by far the Tim Burton film that I like the most, but the majority of the rest I'm not as huge on, you know? But then, you know, so I don't know if I really have any others that I would say, like, don't really work. I think that's probably the closest one.
Well, the one big one that came up for me was Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe in the movie A Good Year.
Okay.
I mean, the movie just seemed so wrong for both of them, and it kind of played that way. You know, Crowe was good in the movie, and the movie was okay and nothing special. But you have these two talents here, Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe, who have, you know, done Gladiator, and they've done movies together for a long time, that, you know, they kind of give you this idea of you know, greatness and manliness, for lack of a better term, and then they roll around with A Good Year, and, you know, no shame in trying to make something different, but it just didn't work. And I guess the same could probably be said, I didn't see it, but the new Robin Hood was met with pretty abysmal reviews, and that was, again, Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe working together again in that very kind of vein that they've done movies before. So that, you could almost suggest, is even worse. I didn't see Robin Hood, so I can't really comment much on it. And then the other one that came up, I blame the director less than I just blame the actress, is Woody Allen and Scarlett Johansson. Now, I don't really think that Johansson is much of an actress, but you have her working with him in two different movies, Match Point and Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and I don't think that she works well in either, but she kind of plays the femme fatale a little bit more in Match Point, so she gets away with it. And then Vicky Cristina Barcelona rolls around, and I don't think she worked at all. So those are two examples of that loyalty, or that director finding an actor that he or she really likes, and putting them in a movie where they don't work. And I think that's bound to happen. It's almost amazing how infrequently it does happen, however.
Yeah, and I think the reason that we don't see it so often is because so many of them, you know, so many of these pairings that we see, they work together so often because it generally it works out. So I think that's probably why. And I think, you know, like you were saying with Russell Crowe and Ridley Scott, you'll have like a good year every once in a while, and maybe a Robin Hood. But then in the past, of course, they've delivered like Gladiator, you know, a big Oscar winning film. So I think the reason we're not seeing too many of them, or at least we're not thinking about too many of them, is just because generally those two probably work together so well that it makes for a much better product.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. And there's no denying the fact that these people continue to work together because they continue to produce quality products. The behind-the-scenes or the lesser movies and stuff, you know, either we don't see, or they're just kind of lower on the scale, and they're lower, like, you're not as famous directors or actors, so we don't notice them. So it's hard to have a discussion about, you know, the director-actor duos, the B directors and the B actors that continue to work together in movies that are, you know, C-minuses, because we don't necessarily see them. They're not as up in the forefront. So it's safe to assume that there are a lot more failures than we can come up with far as these director-actor duos. But like we said, we're talking about some of the big ones. I mean, you have Christian Bale and you have Christopher Nolan working together with The Prestige and with the Batman movies, obviously all very successful. There's a million. You have Pedro Almodovar and Penelope Cruz. You have Woody Allen and Diane Keaton back in the day. You have Elia Kazan and Marlon Brando. Like, the list goes on and on and on about these very successful duos. I just really, like, in preparing for this, I'm like, I was really, really trying to find the failures, because, like, I think that makes for a much more interesting discussion than the one we're kind of having here. Because, I mean, it's easy to sit here and talk about, like, yeah, aren't De Niro and Scorsese movies great? But, like, it really is interesting that there are not, especially with these big duos, there really are not a lot of misses.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of them really crossed my mind, except, you know, thinking about it, the Depp and Burton one, because, you know, just like you, I've got a lot of the ones that have worked. You know, I've got Paul Thomas Anderson and Philip Seymour Hoffman, or John C. Reilly, you know, and David Fincher and Brad Pitt, and, you know, Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and Ben Frost.
There's a miss. Benjamin Button, that's a perfect miss with Brad Pitt and David Fincher. I would definitely say that's a miss. Actually, I would say that above all of all the ones I mentioned, because there you have, I think Pitt, in theory, works for that role because of just, like, his look. You know, he's beautiful. But the movie, that actually is kind of, like, the reverse of what I was thinking as far as a miss. Like, there you have, I think, an actor that might work for the movie, but I just don't think that was Fincher's material.
Yeah.
So in that case, it's the opposite of what I was saying with, like, Russell Crowe and Ridley Scott, or Scarlett Johansson and Woody Allen.
But also with them, it's like, when I thought of putting those two on the list, I wasn't even thinking Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I was thinking Seven and Fight Club.
Right, of course, because those are the movies that they've hit with and that make them a good duo. And then they come on with Benjamin Button, and it wasn't a great movie. And you know, I don't really blame Brad Pitt for that movie, and part of me doesn't even want to blame Fincher because I love him as a director so much, but also knowing how much attention he gives to his movies, I don't know who else to blame. So,
yeah.
But at the same time, like, you know, there's a movie that didn't work with that director-actor duo that has been successful in the past.
Yep, no, I agree with you on that count. Yeah, and going back to the B-movie ones you're talking about, you know, I'm sure if I was more of an aficionado of, like, Roger Corman, I would have probably been able to tell you some of the actors he worked with regularly, but I'm not. I think the closest thing I have to, like, a B... Well, definitely he's a B actor is Bruce Campbell working with Sam Raimi, although Bruce Campbell, and because of Sam Raimi's trajectory in his career, he's kind of just getting cameos in all these really big A movies, even though he's probably the king of the B actors, you know?
Yeah.
So that's probably the closest thing I have to a a B actor director pairing
that were all misses.
Well, I mean, in your opinion, yes.
Yeah, in my opinion, obviously those are successful, popular movies, so that they don't apply to this.
Hey, can I ask you something?
What's forget about it?
What is it?
Forget about it. It's like if you agree with someone, you know, like Raquel Welch is one great piece of ass, forget about it. But then if you disagree, like a Lincoln is better than a Cadillac, forget about it. You know? But then it's also like if something is the greatest thing in the world, like Mingo's peppers, forget about it, you know? But it's also like saying go to hell, too. Like, you know, like, hey, Bully, you got a one-inch pecker, and Bully says, forget about it.
Forget about it.
Bully, forget about it.
Sometimes it just means forget about it.
All right. Thank you very much. I got it.
Let me tell you something. I don't get this bow for Lefty. What?
Forget about it?
Fucking forget about it.
All right, so because the movie 30 Minutes or Less is loosely based on a real-life crime that took place, we decided to do our top five on, you know, films that were based on real-life crime. So, Lee, I'll toss it over to you for your number five and any criteria you may have.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot, as we were just mentioning, you know, whether it's loosely based or based on an aspect of a crime or a character within a crime. So there's a lot of movies that we could have chosen from. So to narrow it down, I basically did my avoid the Get Your Film Fix Top 100. And in doing that, I think I was able to come up with a pretty good list. Starting off with my number five, it is Fritz Lang's M, which Lang claims is not based on a true crime, even though it actually is there, you know, based on a lot of crimes, actually, that took place in Germany way back in the day. Like I said, Lang claims that it's not based on any one, but it's basically a combination of several crimes and child kidnappings and whatnot that took place in Germany. So M is my number five.
Wait, did you say that you were not going to be doing the Get Your Film Fix Top 100 picks on your list?
Wait, yeah, that made our top 100?
That made our top 100.
What number is it?
I don't know. Give me one sec. I'll find out for you.
I didn't think it made it.
I'm pretty sure it did, because I know I had it pretty high on my list. It's an honorable mention for the top five here, but I'm pretty sure that is on there. One moment, and I can give you the number. At number 80.
Number 80.
Fritz Lang.
All right, so considering that I'm leaving out my top, the Gate Film Fix Top 100, my number five is Boys Don't Cry, okay, based on the story of Brandon Tina.
Yep, good pick.
Thank you.
Pick. All right. My number five, and I'm doing a tie because I feel like I haven't done a tie in a long time, and so it's almost like a nostalgia to do a tie.
You know who hasn't done a tie in a long time? It's me.
So we gave you so much crap about it. But anyway, the reason I have three movies and a tie for number five, and the reason they're all tied together, not necessarily on the quality of the film, but because they're all based on the same crimes. So, and that is Silence of the Lambs in the character of Buffalo Bill, Psycho, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which are all based on Ed Gein's crimes, the serial killer.
Really?
Yep. Buffalo Bill was inspired by Ed Gein. Leatherface was inspired by him, and then Norman Bates in Psycho. All God. Three of them inspired by Ed Gein.
That guy was a badass.
I don't know. I mean, don't know if I'd call him that, but he was something.
All right. That's an interesting three picks at your number five. Okay, so my number four is perhaps fitting as we approach the 10-year anniversary of September 11th. It is United 93, directed by Paul Greengrass. I suppose the real-life crime here is simply a plane hijacking. However, it is part of a much larger crime. And this movie, I think, is a little bit underrated, to be honest. I think it's a really good retelling of what the passengers did on that flight and kind of the story surrounding September 11th. I think it got a little bit of pushed aside because it came out somewhat recently after 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's a very good movie and an underrated movie.
No, I absolutely agree with you, and I think you're right. I think a lot of people just didn't want to, you know, watch it just because of the emotions it would have brought up. So I feel like it definitely was underrated and kind of became forgotten because of the subject matter it was dealing with. But yeah, that's a great pick. I didn't even think of that one. That's a good call there. My number four is a more recent film, but I've got it on there because it is a good film, but also just because the story is just so unbelievable. I read the book that the movie's based on as well, and it's I Love You, Philip Morris, which also happened to be our Netflix Instant Pick of the Week this past Friday. But I don't know if you've seen it yet, Lee, but I definitely encourage you to check it out. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I actually thought about watching it last night when I got home from 30 minutes or less, but I was too tired, so I didn't watch it. But yeah, it's definitely a movie I want to check out. I think it's a very interesting-looking movie, and I'm a big Jim Carrey fan. So,
yeah.
All right, my number three, I'm pretty sure, is not on our Get Your Film Fix Top 100, although we discussed this movie a lot because it's a great movie. It is Dog Day Afternoon.
Good pick. Yeah, it's on my honorable mentions there. But, yeah, it's a great movie, another just powerhouse performance by Al Pacino. And, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on his name. You're going to kick me. What's his name there?
The director or the actor?
No, the actor that played like his...
John Cazale.
Thank you, yes. I mean, what was the tally? Like, all five movies he's starred in have been nominated for the Best Picture or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, crazy streak he had there. But, no, it's a great pick.
And I think three of them won Best Picture. The Deer Hunter, Godfather 1, Godfather 2 won Best Picture, and then The Conversation and Dog Day Afternoon were both nominated.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, good pick, man. My number three, I don't know if it's on your list or not. It might be, but I had a tough time not keeping it on here. It's Fargo from the Coen brothers. Actually, I don't think it will be on your list because that's on our top 100. So
it is.
Yeah, because that was not part of my criteria, so... that's why it made my list at number three.
Mr. Mora?
Yeah?
Officer Olson?
Yeah, righto. Well, so I'm tending bar down there at Eklund and Sweden's last Tuesday, and this little guy's drinking, and he says, so where can a guy find some action? I'm going crazy out there at the lake. And I says, what kind of action? And he says, woman action. What do I look like? And I says, well, what do I look like? I don't arrange that kind of thing. And he says, but I'm going crazy out there at the lake. And I says, yeah, but this ain't that kind of place.
Uh-huh.
He says, oh, so I get it. So you think I'm some kind of jerk for asking, only you don't use the word jerk.
I understand.
Then he calls me a jerk, says, last guy thought he's a jerk is dead now. So I don't say nothing. He says, what do you think about that? And I says, well, that don't sound like too good a deal for him then.
You got that right.
Yeah, he says, yeah, that guy's dead, and I don't mean of old age. And then he says, geez, I'm going crazy out there at the lake.
White Bear Lake?
Yeah, well, at Eklund and Swedland, that's closer to Moose Lake, so I made that assumption.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, he's drinking at the bar, so I don't think a whole great deal of it. But then Mrs. Mora, she heard about the homicides down here and thought I should call it in, so I called it in.
It's also not based on a real crime.
It's not based on a real crime?
No, the Coen brothers just said that it is.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you've never heard that story about the woman who went to Minnesota to try to find the money buried in the sand and died?
No.
Yeah,
no, I thought Fargo was based on a real crime.
I mean, it's an interesting... For our listeners who don't know this story, the Coens basically put that at the beginning of the movie because, as Joel Coen says, you can get away with a lot more if people think it's based in reality. So, now, it's not entirely fiction. There are characters who, I think they say, had something to do with some sort of crime similar to that. But basically, it's all made up, and they just put at the beginning that it was a true story.
Huh. Oh,
so bummer. They fooled you into putting it into your top five.
They definitely did. Although, actually, now that I think about it, tying back into our discussion of actor-director teams, Bruce Campbell has worked with... I feel like Bruce Campbell's worked with the Coens every once in a while, but he's always got, like, a cameo as, like he's on the TV screen. Like, in... Because in Fargo, he was. He
really?
Was, like, an actor on the TV, and I feel like he was in, like, the Hudsucker Proxy or something like... Oh, no, he was in the Hudsucker Proxy, not on TV, though, as just a smaller supporting character.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go. All right, sorry.
All right, my number two is Catch Me If You Can, a really fun movie, and based on the conning crimes, the grifting crimes of Frank Abagnale Jr. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Catch Me If You Can is one of those very entertaining movies, I think is the best way to describe it. It's not Spielberg's best work, but it's there's not much wrong with it. Like, it's just very tight, very structured, and very entertaining. And there's good performances from DiCaprio and Hanks in it, and Christopher Walken as well. So, Catch Me If You Can is my number two.
Yeah, that was actually one of the first films I thought of in putting this list together. Although it is an honorable mention on mine, but. Yeah, that was one of the first ones I thought of. But my number two, it may be your number one, I don't know, but it's Terrence Malick's Badlands.
It is not my number one. I'm not nearly as big a fan of that movie as Jeremy. It would be his number one without question. That's a good pick. That's another movie that I understand is just loosely based on certain characters' crime spree.
Yeah, it was based on, like, what is his name? There's a Charles Starkweather and his girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, who I guess it was just a well-known crimes in the late 50s in that area, I think. So it's kind of loosely based on them, so.
All right, my number one is a movie we don't talk about nearly enough on this site, on this podcast, anywhere, really. Nobody talks about it as much as it should be. It's a very underrated movie, but it is Clint Eastwood's Changeling.
It's not my son.
Well, I'm sure you're mistaken.
I'm not mistaken.
Boy, he's been through five terrible long months. He's lost weight. He's changed.
I would know my own son.
All I'm saying is you're in shock and he's changed.
What's your name? Can you tell me your name?
Walter Collins.
Common name.
Where do you live, Walter? You know your home address?
Okay. When you were talking about it, I thought it was going to be the same as my number one. I was be like, oh, this is great. We'll have the same one. It'll be a thing, but it's not. No, but it's a good pick. I do think it's a very underrated movie.
Yeah, it's definitely one that has it kind of falls into that that Fargo ideal that, you know, it's kind of a crime that you wouldn't really believe if it didn't really happen. Like, it's so kind of out there mm-hmm. that it'd be hard to get away with if it wasn't a true story. But unlike Fargo, Changeling actually is a true story based on the chicken coop murders that took place in California.
Yeah, no, it's a great pick. My number one, speaking of David Fincher, is... I think one of his, probably his most underrated movie, and that is Zodiac. Unbelievably great film, starring Mark Ruffalo. I think he has so much, atmosphere and mood in that film, which really helps it because, you know, it's true crimes, but it's crimes that were never solved, you know?
Yep.
There's no real... resolvement in terms of like satisfaction of finding out what happened. So everything that Fincher did in terms of creating that mood and the suspense of the Zodiac killings really is brilliant because he had to do it without having that release of finding out who really was the killer at the end.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I'm glad I made your list. It just missed mine. Honorable mention. I did have a suspicion that it would make yours, so I'm glad that it did, because it's definitely worth mentioning. And perhaps fitting, because we were discussing David Fincher earlier, that is definitely one of his great movies that he's made.
Yeah, do you got any other honorable mentions that didn't get named?
There were some. They were all Get Your Film Fix Top 100, so they're, you know, Goodfellas, I thought about, based on the Lufthansa heist and Henry Hill's crimes. But I don't know. I don't want to go down the whole list because, I mean, there's so many movies that were based on real crimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a couple I had you listed on yours already, and I think the other kind of the notable ones I had was just Monster based on...
Yeah, I thought about that.
And Wonderland based on the... I forget the name. It was like the killings on, you know, the whatever shoot with John Holmes involvement and everything. Those are kind of the two notables that I thought about that... just didn't quite make the cut.
All right.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. You know, as always, we encourage you to check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. If you'd like to donate, there's a donate tab on there. Anything you can give, no matter how big or small, really helps us out. It helps us to keep getting the site going, continuing to do the podcast, video content, all that stuff. You know, all of it costs money, and we appreciate anything people are willing to donate. And we always encourage people to check out our reviews on iTunes, and if you'd like to rate us or write a review, that'd be awesome as well. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.